RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Time for another Health Hacks here at RCR. Dr. Glenn Davies, reversalnz.co.nz, who's been forced to work full-time. Oh, boo-hoo. He's a busy man. We've managed to grab him for this Health Hacks again for a Monday morning. Glenn, how are you? I hope you're not running yourself ragged.
No, actually, I enjoy the people, you know, like that's the joy of practicing medicine. You get to talk to people all day, which I guess is similar to your job.
Yeah, though I don't have it one-on-one. I think if we had our audience all in the same room, it would be a huge squeeze and it would be difficult. But it's funny you say that. I always just think of one person in the room, you know?
Yeah. Well, it does feel like that. I have that same feeling when we're talking now.
I just know when someone says something, about 50 people have something to say about it. That's when I realize that there's more than one. There you go. Anyway, last week's Health Hacks was interesting. And I think that this one kind of is a logical progression. This week, we're talking about what is food. And I think it's at an interesting intersection because we know that the FSANS, that's Food Standards Australia and New Zealand consultation on the change or the possible change of the definition of what is genetically modified food. This could go ahead, and that had a lot of people talking and thinking. The submissions closed last week, and I hope folks, those of you who were motivated to get submissions in, that you did so through the GE Free NZ website. So what is food? And there's also JFK Jr., RFK Jr.'s bringing it to the fore in the US, you know, the whole thing around the food pyramid and ultra-processed food. So it's top of mind, Glenn, is what I'm trying to say here. So we're talking about what is actually food here, which is incredible that we're even asking that as a question to me.
Yeah, I can. This whole discussion around changing the definition of food is a really important topic to me. And if I was to look at it from the food industry's perspective, you know, they're wanting. if I was the advertising voice of the food industry, you know, what I'd be asking for is a more agile environment where new technology and innovation could be brought in to avoid unnecessary delay. And what we would be trying to do is to increase the availability of high quality products at a lower cost, which will benefit everyone. You know, I think that would be something along the lines I would pitch if I was the marketing firm. But the other side of the coin is this huge concern about what those ingredients or food substitutes might look like, and the unknown health consequences of things like genetically modified foods. You know, things like the fake meat and the mock milks, synthetic seafood, you know, all of these things are a real concern. And when I first started thinking about it, it's not like a chicken breast. You know, I think if you want a chicken breast, you're still going to go out and buy a chicken breast, but it's more likely to be the meat patty. And does it actually contain any meat? Or does it contain, you know, proteins, flavor enhancers, flavorings, colorings to create the impression that it's meat, and what sort of controls are over that process, and can we trust the food industry to regulate itself? And I think the answer to that is probably not, because we've seen some terrible examples of the food industry regulating itself, particularly around the star ratings, you know, with something like Milo getting the health food stamp when it's predominantly sugar. You know, so there's a whole lot of apparent you I have to choose my words correctly, Paul. What's the word I'm looking for?
The word that comes to mind for me is they're looking to establish some sort of equivalence with real food.
Yeah,
and how can that be true?
Yeah, and the argument is if it contains the same macronutrient and micronutrient makeup, then it is equivalent. So if it has the same amount of protein, fat, and carbohydrate, and the same amount of vitamins, even if they have all come from powders, then it is the same as the piece of chicken, is the argument, isn't it? And of course, it is not going to be the same in any way.
No way. No way. Yeah. There's a bit missing. Nature.
That's right. But the argument is if it has the same micro and macronutrient content, then the public don't need to know that it didn't begin by being a chicken that came from an egg. They don't need to know that because it's technically the same. And of course, it's not. And of course, I want to know. And that's the discussion that we're having here, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all about knowing. But there's a philosophical question about whether you should, what's the word, reinvent, take over, hijack the actual food chain itself, you know, and pass it off. And then to not label it, that's the other thing, you know, to not be empowered with the information. I thought it was all about being empowered with the information. And, you know, listening, I mentioned RFK, listening to what he has to say, he's basically saying the processed food manufacturers of today are the tobacco manufacturers and promoters and distributors of yesterday. And we've all seen those TV commercials of the doctor smoking and even recommending smoking for things. And I think menthol cigarettes were brought about to help you breathe better. I mean, talk about an oxymoron. So there's past form, there's history that shows that, that they can lie, actually, I would go as to say.
I was thinking about this morning. I imagine that there's layers of this. So there will be a layer, you know, closer to the production of the food of scientists who probably are very well-intentioned, who are probably do have the intention of creating lower cost products that will meet the needs of the customers. But I think above that, there's another layer which will be motivated purely by profit and will not have concern for the health of the community or the individuals. You know, and I'm always aware when we make these criticisms, I think we're putting that criticism largely at board level, because I'm sure there are very well-meaning people working underneath that structure who probably cop the criticism as well.
No,
you know, I think that's possibly true also in the pharmaceutical industry. You know, there probably are people inventing medicines with the intention of helping mankind. That's a level above it where I think the potential corruption is, or the pure motivation by profit only. The main part of the discussion is, you know, what is food? And if it's not a food, therefore it's a non-food. And I think that's equivalent to a poison. So I think we have food and the alternative, which is poison. And I think that's a really clear way of defining this. So let's define what is food. And the best definition I've ever heard is it's recently been growing, walking, swimming, or flying. And without exception, I think that defines what food is.
Yeah, I
got it. It's recently been growing, walking, flying, or swimming. So, you know, that includes vegetables, fruit, meat, fish, chicken, you know, and that is the definition of food. And I think that's excellent. But let's define that a little bit further. I think if food needs to supply all of the macronutrients, which is the carbohydrate, protein, and fat that the body needs, and all the micronutrients that the body needs, that's also a good definition of food. Also, it should promote insulin sensitivity. It should make us metabolically more healthy rather than promoting insulin resistance, which the sugar-laden ultra-processed foods which we've discussed earlier, will contain. So, you know, those are good definitions of food, I think. So, therefore, if it doesn't meet that definition of recently growing, walking, flying, or swimming, then it is a non-food. So, you know, a non-food has been made in a laboratory to some extent. You know, so butter, I would consider a food. Margarine, I would consider a non-food. And when you look at the health consequences of eating those two products, the health consequences of eating butter is that you will be more healthy as a consequence and less inflamed and will be more insulin sensitive compared with eating the margarine, which contains the polyunsaturated vegetable oils, certainly has contained trans fats, which are very toxic and will contribute to joint pain and inflammation. So clear choice. Whether you eat a manufactured meat patty made from protein powders or you eat one made from mince, I think the same would apply. You know, you're going, when you eat the mince, you will be less inflamed, probably more satiated and more healthy from eating that compared with eating the patty that has been constructed in a laboratory.
I would be interested to compare the two, you know, just to see. I'd take one for the team, and compare. I heard someone talking about margarine the other day in a podcast, and I didn't realise this, and it could be wrong, might have heard it wrong. It came out of Napoleon era margarine, wanted a substitute for butter, as I understand it. But it's one molecule away from being plastic, the guy said. One molecule.
Yeah. My understanding is that it's not quite that old, but not an expert in margarine because I don't touch the stuff.
Same. Yeah.
And another thing is, you know, they try and trick you, the food industry, you know, because the Olivani is a really good example. You know, if my understanding is correct, that's still 75% margarine, but it's really well marketed because you just think it's olive oil.
Yeah.
And you think it's olive oil that's gone through a process. It's basically margarine with olive oil added to it. So you got to be a little bit thoughtful about what you're taking in. And that leads me on to my next topic. You can see this, Paul, but I bought a packet of, I won't name the brand because that's not fair, but they're barbecue flavored rice crackers.
Yep, I can see the packet there. Yep.
So I have this box of food that I take with me to conferences, you know, to use as examples of what bad food looks like. And I keep it in the spare room. When the teenagers come home, they go, "Oh, thank goodness you finally bought some decent food," you know, because they eat all the Tim Tams and the pizza and stuff like that. But I want to talk about food labels because I think it's really important that we learn how to read food labels to keep ourselves safe. Now, I've heard someone describe it not as a ingredient list or a food label, but as a warning label, which is quite a good description. So if you look at, read the food label on a piece of broccoli or the food label on a fish. Now, I say that a bit tongue-in-cheek because, of course, a piece of broccoli doesn't have a food label or an ingredient list.
It is the label.
It only contains broccoli.
Yeah.
Equally, a chicken breast only contains chicken. Whereas when you look at the ingredient list on the back of these rice crackers, the first thing is there's two columns. The first one is per serving, and the second is per 100 grams.
Okay.
I would always encourage people to look at the per 100 grams, the second column, because that gives you a percentage. You know, so you're dividing it by 100. So in this case, the carbohydrate content is 80 grams per 100 grams. So this is 80% carbohydrate.
Okay, which would turn to sugar.
And of that, actually not too high, 3.4% of it is sugar. But yeah, all those carbohydrates turn into sugar, so that's a bit irrelevant. So this is 80%, you know, carbohydrate. But the main thing I want to point out on here is when you go to the ingredient list and you start looking through the ingredient list on here, when I find it, and what's interesting is they've folded that little plastic bit over top of it to sort of make it hard. And it's tiny. I'm actually going to have to change my glasses to read the ingredient list. And I think that's deliberate deception. But this contains white rice and some rice bran oil. So white rice becomes sugar. There's about 10, one serving of rice contains 10 teaspoons of sugar, so that's not good for you.
Oh.
Rice bran oil, which is going to be inflammatory. And then the next one is a number. It's an antioxidant, 307B. And my advice would never eat anything that's a number. You know, a food that meets the definition of food is not going to be a number. So I think that's a bit of a warning. The next one, sugar. And then interestingly, the one after that is maltodextrin, which is also a sugar. You know, so they're trying to trick you there because those are both sugars. Then it's got salt and then an emulsifier, which again is a number, 322. So again, avoid that. And then all the rest of the ingredients, onion powder, soy sauce powder, barbecue seasoning blend, garlic powder, flavor enhancer, again, another number, pepper and yeast extract. You know, to me, that does not meet the definition of food. I wouldn't be eating that because I would consider this a non-food and therefore a poison, despite the fact that it's marketed as being gluten-free, having no added MSG and less than 100 calories per serving. So, yeah.
Yeah, the list of ingredients. Okay, everyone wants to be informed and to make a choice and they want to know what's in there. But if you don't actually know what any of that means, that's a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely it's a problem. But keep it simple. If it's a number, you shouldn't be consuming it.
No, but I mean, they should be saying that they should be totaling up the quantity of sugar across all those ingredients. Because that's really, that then means something.
Yep, definitely. What I was going to go on and say, though, is if something has more than five ingredients, you probably should avoid it anyway.
Okay.
This one has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18 ingredients. So that breaks the rule. Don't eat anything with more than five ingredients. And even better, eat things with just one ingredient, broccoli, chicken, meat, fish, you know, cauliflower, one ingredient.
How would you market that now with 18 ingredients?
and three of them are numbers.
Yeah. Our new range is now with 20 ingredients and five numbers. Oh, it's, that's doesn't qualify as food. Absolutely.
But the challenge that we're going to run into is that these manufactured products are going to be cheaper without a doubt, you know, because how the food industry works to some extent is that you take a raw ingredient or raw material like corn, for example, and you extract from that oil, protein, and carbohydrate, and you turn each of those into flours and liquids. You've created a commodity. You then can ship that all around the world, and it can be turned into anything that you like. And then you add to it a whole lot of other ingredients to create the product that you want that has a long shelf life and then can be transported all the way around the world, stored in warehouses, and it can be sold. It can be produced in large amounts. It avoids drought. It avoids famines. You know, it avoids fire. You know, you've created this opportunity to make food really, really cheaply. And if we could trust those manufacturers to make, you know, healthy products, it may not be so bad. But as you've pointed out, we can't necessarily trust them and they don't have a good track record. But the problem is going to be the people who are on the lowest incomes are the ones who are going to be most likely to purchase these cheaper options. If you've got a manufactured artificial chicken patty compared with a chicken breast, I think the chicken patty will be dramatically less expensive, and the people on lower incomes who have the worst health, likely to have the worst health outcomes, it's going to be compounded by now eating the worst foods. So it's going to get worse and worse, and this divide is going to increase. And this whole, the whole messaging in health is around equity, and this is going to create more inequity rather than reducing it. So, you know, I don't think we're moving forward in our main intention to reduce health inequality. I think we're going to make it worse.
Yeah, and as we've talked before, it's only going to cost more in the big picture anyway, because people's health will be worse, and that's more expensive to deal with than consuming real food in the end.
And that's a massively important point, because, you know, having even a hip joint replacement at $25,000, dialysis, you know, a replacement of your heart or kidney, you know, all of these things, ICU care, these are hugely expensive, whereas prevention and doing stuff at primary care level, if it's done well, is dramatically less expensive. Yet we are putting so much of the money into that ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, dealing with people with end-stage health problems, which of course we have an obligation to meet, and I'm not suggesting that we don't.
No,
but if we
no.
could put more effort into prevention and supporting people to make community gardens, you know, raise some chickens in the backyard, you know, all of these kind of things which actually prevent the problem right at the beginning, providing education to kids in school so they go home and tell their parents what healthy food looks like. You know, all of these, you know, grassroots interventions are really where we should be spending the money, because for every dollar you spend there, you're going to be spending $100 or $1,000 or $10,000 at the end. So yeah, spend it well, spend it wisely.
It's a false economy. I'm just wondering, because I'm always curious about these things, and when I went through my cancer, I asked everybody, how much was this costing? What's the bill? Turned out it was about $19,500 for the chemo and the radiotherapy, if you took the hourly rate for the machine and the bags that I had for the chemo. Some would cost a lot more, because it depends on specifically what they're having. So I know that I'd paid about more tax in that year than that. So I felt okay about that. I felt I covered myself. When it comes to things like dialysis, do we know what that costs per person? Do we have any idea the ballpark? Be interesting to know, wouldn't it?
I could have a guess at it, but Paul, I would just be guessing, so I better not do that publicly.
Okay.
But yeah, all of these treatments are really, really expensive, yet a teacher talking to the class at school on what healthy food looks like. Professor Grant Schofield, who I think we're going to be talking to next Monday.
Oh, cool.
He did an interesting public health experiment where he was photographing school lunches. And he told me he literally was in tears when he saw the amount of junk food or the amount of crap or even the lack of healthy food that is in the average kid's lunchbox. And he made the point that this wasn't in low decile schools. This was across the board. This was including, you know, your high income suburbs of Auckland. So it's almost universal. Kids are eating crap, and you understand how it is when you're doing a kid's school lunch. You know, if you can grab one of those little packets of crackers and artificial cheese, or, you know, a packet of chippies, and, you know, it's easier than anything else. But, you know, so you kind of get why the school lunches are so horrible. But you know, we can do better, and we have to do better, and we should be educating. Another lovely story from a small community close to where I live. They did a project at the Kohanga, just where they didn't make a big fuss about anything, but they took the packet of chippies or the packet of twisties out, and they replaced it with a healthier option, like an apple, for example. And then they put gave the packet of twisties back to the child to take home again. That was the intervention. There was no letter that went with it or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to one of the nans, and she said, "I was just so embarrassed when the child brought back the packet of twisties." And he said, "This is not ka pai kai, nan." And
oh,
she
wow.
said,
yeah.
"From then on, you know, she put the sandwiches and the apple in the box." And I went, "Wow, well, that is a really, really powerful intervention."
And simple.
And you know, no intention to embarrass anyone. No intention to call someone out publicly. It was just give it back to the kid to take home again. And I went, "Wow, clever."
You just, again, got me, and this will be controversial, thinking about, you know, school lunches provided. Because, okay, that's a really cool story, but, you know, replicating that one for one is probably not going to be realistic. So I just wonder if the only way to deal with it is just suck it up and put in an army catering system somehow, and so we can... Because it's the ones that don't get it that worry me, you know? And, you know, everything's affected, right? I mean, the ability to learn, fundamental nutrition is not there at a crucial stage of life. Mm-hmm. And even being presented with healthy but tasty and acceptable food as an educational process. I know the argument is that, you know, parents are responsible for their children. They should be doing that work. But many don't. So...
Yeah.
I mean, is it a multi-pronged approach, Glenn, I wonder?
Yeah, that's really hard. One of the topics that, you know, that we have to discuss is most of our nutritional understanding comes from the time when people were undernourished with calories. You know, they were hungry, and that's where most of our nutritional understanding comes from. We're now in this difficult and different situation where we're overnourished with calories, yet we're still undernourished with the vitamins and the minerals and the high-quality proteins and the high-quality fats. So we're largely eating these ultra-processed carbohydrates, which don't provide nutrition. So we've got this double whammy now. The kids aren't necessarily getting all the proteins, minerals, and vitamins they need to make the neurotransmitters to learn, yet they're overweight. Coming back to your comment there about the school lunches, I don't think the school lunches are ideal. They're probably better than the packet of twisties, but, you know, they're still high in carbohydrate and probably not high enough in protein and probably still not high enough in the macronutrients or the micronutrients that the kids need.
If you could put the menu together, though, Glenn,
yeah,
it'd be a different story.
However, the problem is that these individual food items, you know, if you and I were designing it, we would probably have a chicken breast, some broccoli, and some green beans, for example, as the main meal. Those items will individually be more expensive than the sandwich that they're currently getting.
Oh, look, I don't worry about the cost. I'm willing to throw the money at it because I know at the other end it's gonna save. So, whatever.
Yeah.
You know.
Another challenge that we'd face with that option is, are children nowadays used to eating that type of food that we just described, or would they find it unpalatable compared with the addiction that they've developed to the, you know, this ultra processed food, which is always sweet, you know, and it's been designed to meet that bliss point where you get the ultimate dopamine rush from eating that food. So one of the problems that you run into when you're designing these menus for school lunches, do the kids eat it, and are they familiar with that? You know, are we now seeing a generation where people are not used to cooking at home and, you know, sort of ordering a pizza has become the norm?
And wouldn't recognize it, kind of thing. Like, what's that?
I don't think it's got quite that bad, has it? But, you know, I know in places like, for example, Singapore, there's apartments where you don't actually have a kitchen in your apartment because you can just go out onto the street and buy your three meals and it's cheaper than cooking it yourself, are we going to get into that situation where people have forgotten how to cook or, you know, next level, don't actually have a kitchen? When you're cooking in that way, it will also meet those definitions of what whole food is, simply because you've started with ingredients, raw materials, and one step better, what if you can grow it yourself and the kids have been involved in the process of composting and planting and growing the seeds, you know? And I'm very lucky. We have a couple of acres with two steer that are home killed, and we have some big vegetable gardens and a greenhouse, and we have chickens. Actually, I just found that some of them had been laying outside. I found 31 eggs outside under a tree. So, yeah. So they got a telling off yesterday. But, you know, that is what I hope we could potentially get back to. And it's the opposite of what this, you know, idea, you know, around the food safety ANZ is about. You know, it's the opposite of GMO. Yeah. Yep.
Next time you give the chickens a bollocking, please film it. Okay? Because that, my friend, could go viral. It really could.
They don't listen.
No, they sit looking confused. But that would
be funny. It goes something like this, Paul. It goes, the eggs you produce are valuable, but don't forget that you are also a roast chicken potential.
Yeah. do the words chicken breast mean anything to you? Yeah. All right, good to catch up again, Glenn. And so we'll be having Grant Schofield on next chat, will we?
I think we are. It might take a little bit more negotiating, but your producer Bonnie's working on that.
Thank you, Glenn, and I look forward to catching up again.
Thank you, Paul.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.